This is Todd Steed. You're listening to Improvisations. I got a chance to catch up with guitarist Risto Vitchev in San Jose. He was playing there as part of their Summer Jazz Fest. And we talked about a lot of things, including his Monk Collective, which performed that weekend and did one of the best versions of Round Midnight I've ever heard. Here's that interview.
Yeah, basically we have this this group that started not too long ago. It was an idea of the festival, of the San Jose Jazz Organization, to start a collective group, kind of showcasing some of the musicians in the area, some of the local musicians based in San Jose and around San Jose. And the entire idea was to really go around different festivals and advertise San Jose as a jazz city and kind of showcase what's happening musically here. And this year, since it was the 100th anniversary of Thelonious Monk's Bird, we decided to do a program all year round of reimagining Monk's music in our own way. So what we have prepared is everybody in the group is a composer as well as a performer, and so we all write arrangements, and everybody comes from different backgrounds, and so you have some people who are into fusion, other people in traditional jazz, other people in modern jazz and so forth, world music, and so each arrangement is quite different. And it's a great, I think, compilation of kind of showcases of how Monk's music can sound today, 100 years later, and you know, after his birth, you know. So it's a very exciting group.
So can you tell me what your role was? Did you pick out a tune or do an arrangement or something like that?
Yeah, basically when we selected to do the entire program about Monk, I was pretty open, you know, all of us are great colleagues. We play in different settings throughout the year. And so pretty much the idea was like, let's all kind of select our favorite Monk tunes, one or two or three songs, and then arrange them, and then we'll bring them, you know, together in a rehearsal and see kind of what ends up being included in the program. Because, you know, we have like 90 minutes at the festival, so we cannot play all the music. So pretty much it was done very naturally. Everybody threw like their favorite tunes and arranged them. The arrangements I contributed that we're going to perform at the festival, it's Around Midnight, in a very modern fashion, and also Where You Need It, in a very Brazilian samba type fashion. So that was my addition to the
program. Oh, I'm already imagining Where You Need It as a Brazilian.
Yeah, it's pretty fast and a lot of changes, you know, kind of very dense harmony, almost like John Coltrane goes to Brazil, to Rio.
Are you going to record this? It sounds like something that would make a cool record too. You know?
Yeah, you know, actually the idea, because we've already been performing this, you know, for a few months throughout the year, and the idea of recording the record came out a few weeks ago, and I don't know if it's going to be released as a record, but we do have a session already scheduled later this month after the festival to at least record those arrangements and then see what the festival wants to do with it. Because mainly, I mean, the leadership, it's a festival, you know, it's something that it's their artistic control and so forth, and they've been amazing with us, and but eventually if something was to be released or really published out there, it would have to deal, you know, with their financial decisions and support. So hopefully it sees the light of day, but we are taking the same music overseas in 2 months. We are performing at a few festivals in Asia as part of advertising San Jose. And so we're going to be in Taiwan with an extensive tour through a few festivals and clubs, presenting the same program that we are doing tomorrow.
Almost every jazz musician has a lot of Monk tunes in the pocket, yeah, ready to go at any time. But has concentrating on Monk this intently made you appreciate or notice something about Monk you haven't noticed before? Or?
Absolutely. I mean, I've always been a big fan of Monk and his music and how harmonically he uses dissonance and consonance and pretty much the you know, superimposes light and dark and, you know, all of, I love those concepts in music about contrast, you know. But definitely sitting down and arranging something in depth and thinking about all the possible choices makes you at least look a few layers deeper into somebody's work, and then you start to find stuff like, whoa, this, you know, I've been playing this music all along, but I never thought of how deep it is, you know, kind of stuff. And I think those processes as a musician, you only discover if you really spend time with the music, which usually is the case when you sit down to arrange or reharmonize or things like that, you know. And definitely for me, at least personally, I've discovered a whole different layer of Monk that wasn't familiar with before, you know.
As a composer yourself, do you take anything from Monk's music? You know, you're studying it, you're learning it. Do you think, like, while as a composer, this is something I this opens me up as a composer, or does it have that effect?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've been a big fan of him as a composer ever since I had an interest composing. And the one thing that really kind of excited me tremendously from the beginning, it's his willingness to take chances and not caring, and like doing these weird harmonies and things that would sound dissonant and definitely unorthodox, especially in the time that he was doing it. You know, his harmonic sense, rhythmic sense was definitely not the mainstream at the time of the creation of those pieces. And that, as a composer, it definitely takes some guts, you know, to do that. A lot of times, I think the hardest thing, it's being so exposed and being so honest with what you want to say, but also letting it out there for everybody to take a piece and critique. And that's something very hard. It's almost like the equivalent of declaring love to someone and being so fragile and exposed, but also not caring. Also saying, this is me, I'm 100% me, and I don't care what other people think. And that's what you get, you know, the real me. I think that's it's kind of, you have to be very brave to do that. And a lot of composers, I think, takes them a lot of years to mature to the level where they say, well, I want to only play a triad, and that's okay. You know, my colleagues are not going to say, this is too simple, this guy, it's, you know, like a lot of times, you know, I found on myself when I was in my early composing stages, I would write something I really liked, but then I would look at it objectively and say, well, people are going to laugh at this, it's too simple. I'm a jazz musician, it has to be complex, it has to be challenging. And then I would end up adding all these other things in the arrangement that kind of really buried the entire original message, just to be perceived what I thought would be a nice perception by my colleagues, you know, without caring about the real intent of the music. And it took me quite a few years to overgrow that and say, you know what, this is how I feel, and that's it.
And, have you noticed that evolution in your last couple of records, where you're not thinking like, I'm a jazz musician, you're thinking like, this is what I want to express?
Absolutely. I mean, I think definitely with the last two, at least that's the one that I felt the more comfortable saying, I'm just a musician. And, you know, I happen to play an art form that it's improvisational in nature, but I don't want to put any labels. So if today something that I wrote sounds like baroque or sounds like it comes from warm music or sounds that come from rock or heavy metal, so be it. I mean, it's a musical feeling that was most likely influenced by my environment and the surroundings and everything that goes around the world. And sometimes we cannot help, but, you know, we have bad influences, good influences, you know. And I think it's the truest message comes out when we don't put any filter and we don't try to hide it by putting it in a box. Just because I'm a jazz musician, I don't want to apply all the kind of the mainstream tools of that language to pretty much cover or color the original idea. I just want to let it do whatever it is, you know.
So. Can you think of a specific song, say, on your last couple of records that you feel like, wow, this one really connected what I was going for to the listener, you know, or this one came out just so perfectly? I mean, do you ever feel that?
Yeah, I mean, I do feel that. It's very hard to judge because this is so subjective that maybe I'm thinking I'm connecting with the listener, and maybe on the other side the listener is thinking, what is this, right? But I mean, I definitely, when we perform live, you can sense the energy of the people. And there's the second track of my newest record of Light and Shadows, called The Shortest Wavelength. That track, I mean, in my opinion, if you just listen to it, it's closer to heavy metal or rock than it is to jazz. And I just felt there was this, it had to be aggressive, it had the bite, it reflected this uneasiness, this turmoil inside, you know. And pretty much the entire rhythm part of the guitar, it's power chords, something that rock musicians use, jazz musicians don't play that kind of stuff, you know. And every time we play it live, the audience just has this like kind of look in their face like, whoa, you're allowed to do this, you know. This is okay. We still enjoy it, you know. So I think that one, it brings a few smiles. And
that's what I really like about your records is that when I put them on, I don't know where I'm going. You know what I mean? Because I mean, there's nothing.
Hopefully,
wrong.
We get somewhere.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing wrong with a record where, you know, it's just a piano trio with ballads, yeah. And it's enjoyable. That's fine. But I also really appreciate a record where I put it on, I'm like, I don't know where this is going. And it goes in directions I don't expect, right. Like you're talking about, like a heavy metal or a prog rock.
Yeah, exactly.
I hear prog rock in there. Or even the guitar sounds, you know, sometimes you're like,
exactly.
Oh, this is a, you know, this is kind of breaking a rule.
Exactly. I mean, for me as an artist, it's always, as an artist who consumes art too, like as a listener, I should say, I love that the best art is the one that challenges my imagination and that surprises me. That I cannot predict the outcome. I love, and just watching movies. I love movies that I cannot predict the plot, that have twists and turns. Like that, there's nothing more boring for me than watching a movie that with a predictable plot. The superhero that's gonna save the girl at the end is gonna be that. I mean, that's why I watch it. I already know what's gonna happen.
Yeah, save yourself 2 hours.
Exactly.
So, do you feel like your guitar sound itself is also like evolved over time? And so how?
Definitely. I mean, I think I'm, as a guitar player, we're always looking for the different toys and pedals and amplifiers and just whatever you're listening at every current moment influences like some of the things that you want to sound like, right? And I definitely have to say my sound from the very first record I did to the latest, my sound has become more electric and more closer to what I just called modern guitar sound, not particular jazz sound. I even switch a lot of things in my gear that I use. I used to use full-size archtop guitars and acoustic nylon string guitars, and now I'm favoring more instruments that are more closer to a solid body guitar. And the main instrument I play now, it's a very thin, it's completely hollow archtop guitar, but it's very thin, which gives it a lot of sustain closer to like a Telecaster or Stratocaster type guitar, but it still has that very warm, deep sound which comes from the acoustic properties of the instrument.
Is it a custom made guitar? What kind of guitar is it?
No, it's not a custom made. It's a company, it's a builder. He's an archtop builder based in Japan, in Tokyo, and the company is called Westville Guitars. He is known for making the signature Kurt Rosenwinkel models. So Kurt plays those guitars. There's a great guitar player in New York, Ricardo Grilli, who's a great Brazilian guy who also endorses them, and I just got an endorsement last year with them. And so I've been so happy with the instrument, and it's been like my main baby for the last year and a half now.
What about amps? So like, do you switch out amps? Or
I used to play all solid-state amplifiers for that super clean, crystalline sound, and for the last 2-3 records, I went into the tube amplifiers and kind of like the old school, you know, dynamic range and warmth of the tube amp. So I've been trying quite a few different tube amplifiers over the last years. I do endorse Mesa Boogie amplifiers. So I play Mesa Boogies whenever I have the chance. But you know, whenever we travel and you tour, it's very hard to play the same amplifiers. Pretty much you're at the mercy of what the venue has or what the backline company has. So it's very hard to stick to one amplifier, which sometimes can be a challenge because you get used to a sound and then you have to try to recreate it or kind of tweak everything else you have to compensate for whatever the amplifier response is. But it's been fun. It puts you kind of a little edge each night to find something new about your sound too. You know?
Now you've been talking about, you know, San Jose is really trying to establish itself as a jazz city. You're talking about they're sending you on a tour to
Asia.
You know, the jazz festivals here, obviously. What is it about this place that developed this consciousness of like, we're a jazz city? I mean, not a lot of cities will have that, really.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think in my, again, and I can be completely wrong, my personal take on this is that, you know, for the longest time, you know, the entire Bay Area feels like one big city, right? It's all connected. San Francisco, Oakland, Berkeley, San Jose. But San Jose has always, I think, felt like the underdog, missing that culture, because San Francisco has a great jazz legacy. Oakland has an amazing jazz legacy in Berkeley. And so they've always felt, well, we're kind of the same. We all think of ourselves as Bay Area folks, you know, it's like the valley, you know. But at the same time, the fame and all the kind of big applause goes to San Francisco always or Oakland. So I think San Jose has been trying very hard over the years to like, we're the south part of the Bay also exists, and we're here too, you know. And it's funny because a lot of the musicians, you know, as it happens in every major city, all the musicians that really make San Francisco a jazz city, they don't live in San Francisco. They cannot afford to.
With
all the Silicon Valley companies and all the, you know, the startups and the entire technology center of the universe being here, I mean, no artist, unless you're an engineer making six-figure salaries, you can, you know, definitely not afford to live in San Francisco. So that has driven all the artists, and they do work there, but they live all in the South Bay or live across the Bay in Oakland and stuff. And so, in a way, the same people who create the culture in San Francisco are really the people who live here. And so why not kind of showcase them as in the local community, you know, kind of stuff. And so I think it's a great idea. And it's definitely over the last few years has been I think it has been definitely growing, kind of gaining momentum, and do people do now come to San Jose to see jazz? You know, even sometimes people from the city will drive in here, and there's been a few new clubs that have opened, and definitely the festival, it's a strong festival here, so it's great. I mean, we'll see how in this business we never know how things last, how long, they last. But they last until they do. You know?
That's right.
So we'll see where it goes.